You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this episode is presented by Jim Duffy.
Gender critical belief. For some, it's a philosophical belief worthy of and requiring protection under the law, a simple expression of undeniable reality. For others, it's a license to deny the reality of trans people and the lives that they seek to live. As that debate rages through our politics, our media, our culture wars, the courts inevitably find themselves presented with claims from one side or the other, and a nascent jurisprudence is beginning to emerge. Indeed, we're recording this episode during the UK Supreme Court hearing in For Women Scotland and the Scottish Ministers, where a campaign group is challenging the lawfulness of statutory guidance issued by the Scottish Government, which has the effect that a gender recognition certificate recognising that a person's gender is female brings them within the Equality Act's definition of a woman. Now, here to discuss with me the vexed questions this whole debate throws up are two of my One Crown Office Row colleagues who, like me, practice in employment, discrimination and human rights, Alistair Henderson and Paula Kelly. As well as his work at the bar, Alistair is a commissioner for the Equality and Human Rights Commission, but you'd probably like me to say, Alistair, that the views you express on this edition of the podcast are your own.
Important caveat, yes.
Meanwhile, before life as a barrister, Paula acted as a parliamentary advisor, including to Labour's shadow ministerial team on Brexit when the party was in opposition. Alistair, Paula, welcome to LawPod UK.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Thanks, great to be here.
Paula, I'm not going to begin by asking you what is a woman. Perhaps we'll build up to that, but perhaps we could start with a bit of an explainer on what's meant by gender critical belief.
Yes, Jim. Well, this is an umbrella term that encompasses philosophical beliefs about sex and gender and the relationship between them as a matter of law, policy, and societal norms. Broadly speaking, those with gender critical beliefs consider biological sex to be immutable, such that an individual born male cannot become female or vice versa. And this is by contrast to the belief that an individual can transition between sex and gender, and perhaps even that there are a multitude of genders. The simplistic way, as you pointed out, Jim, to consider this debate is the statement that a woman is an adult female. Those with gender critical beliefs would treat that as an uncontroversial, matter-of-fact statement of biological reality. However, those on the other side of the argument might consider that to be inflammatory and perhaps even transphobic. I say broadly speaking because it is important to note that gender critical beliefs are not homogenous, and there are different approaches with varying nuances and emphases. To give just one example, one individual who has gender critical beliefs might say that they wouldn't use an individual's preferred pronouns or name at all, whereas others might consider doing so as a matter of courtesy, but not that they should be legally compelled to do so.
Yeah.
This can come from two different approaches, the religious, Christianity, and also the more traditional feminist critique of gender and sex.
The political storm raging around these issues is taking place against the somewhat quieter rumblings within the courts. It may be worth examining where we're up to on discrimination claims brought in the workplace. And those claims have been about whether holding a gender critical belief amounts to a protected characteristic, i.e. protected under the Equality Act. And to hold that status, it would have to amount to a protected philosophical belief. And that's where we get into some pretty fine distinctions, isn't it? I mean, there's one case that I always think illustrates those distinctions quite well.
Are you about to talk about the Rangers support one?
Yes, Ali, I thought you might know where I was going. But yeah, the Rangers case is quite a useful illustration of how fine these distinctions can be and where the cases might lie, whether on one side or the other of the relevant line, because it was brought in the Employment Tribunal by a man who claimed that being a Glasgow Rangers fan amounted to a protected belief. that might sound particularly strange to anyone who, unlike you and I, Alistair, didn't grow up in Glasgow.
Exactly.
Or you, Paula, in Northern Ireland. For us, it's perhaps surprising it took until 2022. The claimant was dismissed from a construction company and claimed that his manager, who was a fan of guess who, Celtic, didn't offer him work because of his support of the Rangers. The claimant cited the fact that he spent most of his disposable income on attending Rangers matches, that he'd created memories with his father and his son, and that it was an intrinsic part of his existence. He supported some of the philosophies that he said came with being a Rangers fan, allegiance to the monarch, support for the union, and so on. And I think this is the only time a court has tested that quote from Bill Shankly. Some people believe football is a matter of life and death. It's much, much more important than that. I'm not sure this employment tribunal would have agreed with that, because it found that Rangers hysteria did not meet the Granger criteria. It didn't use those exact words, but let's look at what the Granger criteria are. Because in order to qualify as a protective philosophical belief, then the belief must meet the criteria set out in Granger PLC and Nicholson, which is a case in the Employment Appeal Tribunal from 2009. So there are five factors. It must be genuinely held. It must not simply be an opinion or viewpoint based on the present state of the information available. The third factor is that it must be a belief as to a weighty and substantial aspect of human life and behaviour. Fourth, the belief must attain a certain level of cogency, seriousness, cohesion, and importance. And fifth, it must be worthy of respect in a democratic society, be not incompatible with human dignity, and not conflict with the fundamental rights of others. So there are probably about 25 criteria packed into those five, but those are the Granger criteria. And Alistair, the most well-known case in this area is probably the Maya Forstater case.
Yeah, that's right. So coming back from the realms of football to the gender debate that we are focusing on in this podcast, the most well-known case probably in this area in the last few years is that of Maya Forstater. First hit the tribunal in 2018 and finally reached a conclusion in 2022 after a successful appeal by Ms. Forstater to the Employment Appeal Tribunal. So the story is basically as follows. Ms. Forstater lost her role as an advisor on tax policy at an international development think tank called the Centre for Global Development after expressing the view on social media that transgender women couldn't change their biological sex. Several members of the think tank staff, mainly based in America rather than in London, complained about her comments. She was asked if she would make it clear that those comments were just her own rather than those of CJD, and she agreed to that. She was also asked if she'd be careful about the tone, and she said, oh, of course, I'm very happy to do that. But despite that, CJD then went on to commission a diversity and inclusion consultant called Quantum Impact, great name, from San Francisco, to do a fact-finding exercise. They did two reports, one of which was just kept internal, which decided that what Ms. Forstater had said was offensive and discriminatory. And then another one, which was shown to her, said that some of the things she'd said did cross the line or almost crossed the line in terms of respectful workplace-based conduct, but didn't actually say how or when. She tried to give a response to that, but despite it, the leadership decided to end her contract and not renew it and not give her another post. So she brought a claim for discrimination on grounds of religion or belief against the think tank. And what happened was there was a preliminary hearing to decide the question of whether or not her gender critical beliefs were a protected belief for the purposes of the Equality Act. And of course, the tribunal then had to consider whether all of those criteria, the Granger criteria, were met. Now, there was no dispute about whether the first few criteria were met. The dispute all came down to the fifth one that you mentioned, Jim. Basically, whether or not this belief was worthy of protection in a democratic society. And somewhat surprisingly, she lost on that point at first instance. The tribunal said, no, we don't think it is. So she appealed to the appeal tribunal, and that handed down a key decision, which really is now the go-to judgment on the Granger criteria, not just on gender-critical beliefs, but more broadly. The then president of the Employment Appeal Tribunal, Justice Chowdhury, reviewed the case law extensively and held that only beliefs which fell outside the scope of Article 9 of the European Convention of Human Rights would fail to satisfy that fifth criterion of grandeur. So those would have to be the kinds of beliefs that are akin to Nazism or totalitarianism.
Yeah.
So very, very high bar. And as long as that very high bar wasn't met, then the tribunal shouldn't really be focusing on evaluating the value of any particular belief. They should be focused instead on the actual facts of the case in front of them and how that belief was manifested.
Yes, it's a really interesting feature of these cases, the interplay between the ECHR's approach to Article 9 and the approach to the Granger criteria and so on. But that's Forstatter, so the biggest case so far, and it was followed fairly hot in the heels, Paula, by the case of McArath.
Yes, Jim. McArath against CWP and Advanced Personnel Management Group. This differs from Forstatter in two respects. Firstly, it concerned gender-critical beliefs that were based on religious faith. And secondly, it was about conduct in work, namely a Christian doctor who was acting as a health and disabilities assessor in respect of the DWP's administration of disability-related benefits. Now, the doctor in this case indicated in his induction training that he would not use the pronouns or titles that were inconsistent with a service user's natal sex. And this was in breach of the DWP's policy on that. The respondents did succeed in the employment tribunal and the judgment was upheld on appeal. However, Mrs. Justice Eady found that the employment tribunal had actually erred by finding that the claimant's beliefs did not amount to protected beliefs, but they had not erred in finding that he had not been discriminated against or harassed on the basis of those protected beliefs. Dr. McArath indicated that he would not comply with this policy, and therefore the employer considered whether there were ways of accommodating his belief by reference to guidance from ACAS and the General Medical Council. And they did so in two ways, whether they could assign him to a non-customer-facing role or if there was any way of ensuring he did not assess any transgender service users. However, they concluded that neither was feasible. Therefore, the second respondent asked the claimant to clarify his position. Quite importantly, in terms of the judgment, he left work the following day. He left early, saying that he could not fulfil his role to the best of his ability due to the ongoing situation. And the second respondent agreed that this was for the best. Dr. McArath later claimed this amounted to a suspension. The second respondent set out its position that they understood that Dr. McArath had left by his own volition and that he felt he could not return. Therefore, the second respondent requested that he would confirm whether he would follow the agreed process in his training and refer to a service user by their chosen sexuality and name, and indicated that they would happy to provide help and support on this. However, if he was not willing to do so, they would respect the decision and his right to leave the contract. Dr. McArath replied that his faith precluded him from doing so, and the second respondent thanked him for his work. Dr. McArath responded claiming that he had been sacked. In the employment tribunal, Dr. McArath characterised his beliefs in the following terms. The belief in the truth of Genesis 1:27 that a person cannot change their sex or gender at will, and that attempting to do so was pointless, self-destructive and sinful. Secondly, that a lack of belief in transgenderism and gender fluidity, such that he did not believe that an individual can change their sex or gender, that it was beneficial for them to do so, or the society should accommodate such a change, which he referred to as impersonation. Finally, that it was irresponsible and dishonest for a health professional to accommodate a patient's transition to the opposite sex. As I've said, the Employment Appeal Tribunal did accept that the original panel had erred by not finding these beliefs were protected beliefs, but they upheld the finding that Dr. McArath had not been subject to either direct discrimination and harassment or indirect discrimination. On direct discrimination and harassment, the Employment Appeal Tribunal was satisfied that the reason that the second respondent had sought to clarify Dr. McArath's position was not because of his beliefs, but because they wanted to treat all service users in the manner of their choosing, and therefore it was not a discriminatory act. This is a subtle difference, but an important one. On indirect discrimination, It did not accept his contention that there was a group disadvantage, namely because it held that there were different views amongst Christians on this issue. In any event, it found that there was no error by the appointment tribunal, that the policy was a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim, and this was not challenged by Dr. McCarrath. This was a very early reminder after Forstadter that the fact that gender-critical views are a protected belief isn't the end of the conversation. It is only one stage in the analysis, and the fundamental factual determinations still apply.
Thank you, Paula. So we'll come back, Alistair, to the employment tribunal in the line of cases following Forstadter and McCarrath. But alongside the developments in that jurisdiction, an administrative law case has been making its way through the Scottish courts, and that's the For Women Scotland case that I referred to earlier. And you've been following that on its way to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, that's right. I've been following it carefully. And actually, the Equality and Human Rights Commission has intervened in that case. I mean, that's a fascinating case because that's actually all about, as you indicated, Jim, the very definition of male, female, man, woman in the Equality Act. So the definition of sex. And broadly speaking, the two camps are the appellant for Women Scotland are saying it should be interpreted as biological sex, the sex you're born with, or natal sex, whereas the Scottish Government is contending that it should be legal sex or certificated sex. In other words, it also includes someone who's got a gender recognition certificate under the Gender Recognition Act. I should say the Commission's position, the Equality and Human Rights Commission's position that we intervened on, was a sort of in between, because we basically said we agree with the Scottish ministers that the current law does seem to be, Parliament's intention in the Equality Act does seem to have been, to have legal sex or certificated sex, but that actually does create quite a lot of problems, and those problems have become more and more obvious as the law's been developed and as some of these cases, for example, have arisen in how that's applied and how various provisions of the Equality Act actually work in practice. And so as a result, Parliament might well want to have a look at this again and decide whether or not the definition is right or needs to be, you know, reapplied, the balance of rights needs to be done in a different way. So it's a complicated issue. So that's a kind of keenly awaited judgment that will hopefully come out, you know, fairly soon.
I said earlier that we're often dealing with fine distinctions in this area, and it seems that the key distinction when it comes to individual claims is the difference in treatment down to the fact the person holds the belief or because of how they've gone about expressing that belief. Have they done it in an insulting way, in an antagonistic way? And there's quite a useful illustration of that distinction in a case called Page and NHS Trust Development Authority, a judgment of Lord Justice Underhill. And what you're looking for are the mental processes involved, often something that's quite difficult to divine in an employment tribunal. But one leading case on this is Higgs and Farmer School, and another follows on quite nicely, Paula, from your case of McCarrath. The claimant worked as a work experience manager in a school. She was a Christian. She'd posted some comments on Facebook. She was criticising sex education that was being delivered and was concerned about what was being said about gender fluidity, and the words "they are brainwashing our children" were used. She was disciplined, she was dismissed, and she alleged that she'd been discriminated against as a result of her beliefs. And this claimant lost at first instance, but the EAT, the Employment Appeal Tribunal, overturned the finding and concluded that the tribunal had erred by not engaging with the key question. And that was there a close or direct nexus between the Facebook posts and the protected belief? And it had to, and this goes back to the interplay here with the approach of the European Court of Human Rights, it had to carry out a proportionality assessment. Otherwise, the foundational nature of the claimant's rights to freedom of belief and freedom of expression could not be properly weighed in the balance. What was the reason why she was dismissed? The EAT emphasised that these cases are context-specific. What was the limitation or restriction in the case in question, and was it objectively justified? And it set out some basic principles, which, as I say, echo very closely the approach to balancing rights that one sees in Strasbourg Court. And another major recent and high profile staging post in all of this, Alistair, is the case of Adams and Edinburgh Rape Crisis Centre, which people will have read about.
Yeah, that's the much more recent case. And judgment was handed down in May of this year, 2024. And then a fairly sizable compensation award was confirmed earlier, just in November of this year. I have to say, it's an almost perfect example of how an employer should not handle this sensitive area. Roz Adams was a counselling support worker for Edinburgh Rape Crisis Centre. Now, shortly after Ms Adams joined, the respondent appointed a new chief executive officer, Mridul Wada, who was a trans woman. And actually, the evidence seemed to be Ms Adams originally welcomed that. She was quite keen to ensure that the Rape Crisis Centre's services were as trans-inclusive as possible. She didn't have any issue with it. But she did believe that biological sex was very relevant in relation to sexual violence, and that a trauma-informed approach to supporting survivors of sexual violence entailed respecting their understanding of others as male and female, their choice about whether or not they wanted to have a male or a female support worker. So what happened was, one of Ms. Adams' colleagues, let's just call them B, so B understood she's biological female, but she identified as non-binary, and advised that they change their name to a male-sounding name. And Ms. Adams and her colleagues sought guidance from their line manager as to what to say. So if a service user asked whether this colleague B was a man, what should they say in response to that? And no clear guidance was given. And it turned out that that wasn't a theoretical concern, because a service user then actually did email in and ask exactly that question. So Ms. Adams emailed her line manager again and B, this other colleague, asking for guidance on how to respond. What happened then is that B complained about that to the CEO, saying that they felt humiliated by the claimant's emails. They didn't want to deal directly with her ever again. The CEO replied in terms which made it clear that they'd already decided that Ms. Adams was going to be disciplined about this, and included the line, "Transphobia exists in our organisation, as do other prejudices." And that all led to a long drawn out disciplinary process, which upheld all the allegations, or most of the allegations made against Ms. Adams. In response, Roz Adams resigned. She lodged a claim for harassment, for direct and indirect discrimination, and for constructive dismissal. And the tribunal found for her on all main points and was completely damning of Edinburgh Rape Crisis Centre in a lengthy judgment. So just to give you some highlights, and as I say before, this really was an example, I think, of how not to go about a situation like this. The tribunal found that the colleague, B, their reaction to Roz Adams' questions and requests for guidance were completely overblown and unreasonable. They found that the CEO's emails, which prejudged the outcome of the disciplinary process and accused Roz Adams of transphobia, were egregious, and that it was clear for the way that the CEO and other senior managers acted that the real reason for the treatment, and this is your point, Jim, it all comes down to what's in their heads. It was very clear that what was in their heads was that the real reason to discipline her was not anything she'd actually did or said, so not the manifestation of her beliefs, but the very fact that she held gender-critical views at all. And the tribunal held that the way in which she went around asking for guidance, to characterise that as humiliating to her colleague or transphobic, was simply nonsense. It was very clear that it was a respectful, careful request. The tribunal characterised the whole chain of events by which the disciplinary process was started as being a heresy hunt. So it became clear that Edinburgh Rape Crisis Centre had decided they just disagreed entirely with Roz Adams' views and were just going to kind of get her out. And then what's interesting as well is that the tribunal then went on to say, even if Ms. Adams' beliefs themselves hadn't been the real reason for the treatment, and they found that they were, they went on to consider whether the treatment would have been discriminatory on the basis that amounted to discrimination on the grounds of manifestation of the beliefs. And in doing so, it weighed up some of the competing convention rights. So it looked at freedom of expression, freedom of belief, and also the Article 8 rights potentially of trans people. And what was very interesting is the tribunal concluded that it very clearly would also have been direct discrimination on the basis of manifestation here. They noted that, you know, whilst some individuals might be very sensitive about having their gender history revealed, that wasn't something that automatically flowed from the existence of a right to privacy. And whilst there might be some situations it wasn't appropriate, actually in the vast majority of cases, there's nothing controversial about asking someone their biological sex, their sex at birth, or their gender identity. So you just look at the context, you see if it's justified. And in this case, it was a rape crisis centre. It was entirely appropriate for Ms. Adams to say, I've got a good reason here to ask for it.
Yeah. Now, 2024 has been quite a big year in terms of judgments in this area, because if we rewind a little bit to January, we had two decisions handed down, Phoenix and Mead. Paula, perhaps you could talk us through Mead and I'll then deal with Phoenix.
Mead was a case of a social worker who took a case against her employer, Westminster City Council, as well as her regulator, Social Work England. Like Forstatter, this was about expressions of gender-critical beliefs posted on personal social media. Interestingly, most of the background giving rise to this case took place before the Employment Appeal Tribunal's judgment in Forstatter, but the hearing and the judgment were post-Forstatter. Miss Mead had a Facebook page with an audience of around 40 people. Amongst those 40 people were a few of her colleagues. One of those colleagues reported to the regulator that she had posted transphobic content and donated to groups that discriminated against transgender people. Some of these posts, up to 70, were eventually identified, included petitions about trans women's participation in female sports, the use of single-sex spaces, and posts about women's prisons that could be considered satirical or inflammatory, depending on your perspective. Social Work England's fitness to practice rules prohibit social workers from discriminating against anyone and also from any use of social media that is unlawful, unethical, or which brings the profession into disrepute. Following the complaint from Ms. Mead's colleague, the regulator investigated her and warned her that there was a reasonable prospect that her fitness to practice would be held to be impaired. It did conclude that there was no evidence of any transphobic conduct on her part at work, but did find that her social media activity constituted a pattern of discriminatory behaviour over an extended period of time. The regulator then informed the employer, Westminster City Council, about the report and the sanction. Now, internally, the employer confirmed that it had no concerns about her practice, but it did suspend her on the charges of gross misconduct that same day.
That's really striking, isn't it? So they had like no basis at all for thinking she was actually going to discriminate in the workplace, but both her regulator and the employer then go, oh, well, because of what you've said, we sort of assume that you might.
Yes, and interestingly, the tribunal actually went on to find that that didn't constitute direct discrimination. They considered it quite reasonable that an employer who was informed of such a sanction would have grounds to suspend someone. But it was only the subsequent disciplinary investigation that then began to amount to direct discrimination.
Yeah.
But it is interesting in this context of the question about the actual conduct in work and how clear a line can be drawn between the personal conduct and the manifestation of any beliefs in the workplace. I suppose there are some professions where that would be a more definitive line than others.
Yeah, that seems to be right. And even then, though, so for example, this one is social work. Higgs, the similar issue kind of arises, and that's a teacher. But even then, it does seem to be, you have to be pretty sure that there's going to be something in the workplace or have some real basis for it before it becomes a problem.
Absolutely. Now, that disciplinary investigation concluded that Ms. Mead did have a case to answer about discriminatory use of social media and support for discriminatory groups. She was then issued with a final written warning and lifted her year-long suspension. In May and June of that year, Forstatter was handed down. And later that year, Ms. Mead challenged the regulator's sanction despite having accepted it, which the judgment does acknowledge was quite unusual. Social Work England decided that the social media posts were in fact not offensive and that proceedings with respect to her fitness to practice should be discontinued. Unsurprisingly, she then succeeded in her appeal against the employer's final written warning. Turning to the judgment, the tribunal held that, in line with Forstatter, all the beliefs expressed did fall under the category of protected belief and were particularly dubious about the argument run by the respondents that whilst they accepted that they were protected beliefs, the expressions of them went beyond the reasonable manifestation of the beliefs. The tribunal held, we do not consider that any of the 70 posts were abusive, incited hatred or violence, or defamed any individual. Now, as we've discussed, the tribunal actually found that the suspension itself did not relate to the protected belief, but it was due to learning that Ms. Mead was subject to proceedings by her regulator. However, the tribunal also found that the employer was no longer simply reacting to the regulator by the time it initiated disciplinary proceedings and found that they were related to the protected belief.
That's a really interesting distinction, isn't it, Paula? Because it's, you can see why they had sympathy for the employer when they first get, you know, your regulator has said that you've breached your professional conduct, that they might go, oh, help, we've got an issue here. But once they became aware of what the actual concern was, they needed to actually think about it a bit harder and decide that there probably wasn't anything in it.
Yes, and particularly because these disciplinary proceedings were quite protracted and the handling of the disciplinary proceedings were criticised quite heavily by the tribunal. They found that the disciplinary proceedings amounted to harassment and indirect discrimination. The tribunal found that little regard had been paid in the investigation to the tone of the posts, which they found was not of a level of inappropriateness to vitiate the protection for the manifestation of beliefs. And indeed, the very limited audience, particularly as it was her personal social media, and it did not represent or purport to represent the employer's views. Therefore, the tribunal held that there was not only no risk of reputational damage, but absolutely no reputational damage to the employer because of the posts. Another interesting aspect of this judgment relates to the investigation itself. The tribunal was very critical of the investigation and the way it was conducted, honed in on the fact that the investigator included within a report her own views on the debate, namely that the claimant's social media posts were transphobic. It considered it surprising that the investigator considered appropriate to set out her personal views on what is a very highly contentious issue and said that it would give rise to an understandable concern from the claimant's perspective that the investigator was not considering matters from an objective perspective, but rather from a preordained view, that the views espoused by the claimant were less worthy of respect than the opposite side of the debate. Indeed, the tribunal went on to find that referring to the post as transphobic in and of itself would constitute harassment.
Yeah, there seem to be two ways really for employers to get into trouble in these cases, based on what we've heard. I mean, there's the all guns blazing approach. You've got Adams and Mead as good examples, but seeking to stick one's head in the sand or walking on eggshells can be just as problematic. The Phoenix case is quite a good illustration of that. So this is the case about Professor Joe Phoenix, who was found to have been subjected to a targeted campaign of harassment after having helped launch a gender-critical research network at the Open University. And her employer failed to protect her out of a fear of repercussions arising from being seen to support the claimant and her gender-critical beliefs. The claimant resigned as a result and was found to have been constructively dismissed. The employer's failure to remove a signed public letter after the claimant had left its employment was adjudged to have constituted continuing harassment in this case. So the letter referred to the claimant as having made transphobic comments, so echoes of Mead, and associated the gender critical network with putting lives at stake. And it had called for the Open University to deplatform the network. So the university had victimised the claimant, the tribunal found, by deciding not to continue with her grievance after the end of her employment because she'd brought a tribunal claim against them. So I think that case shows that it's no answer for an employer to approach these thorny issues by doing nothing. Copping out isn't going to get you off the hook of a discrimination claim. So that brings us towards the end of a whirlwind tour of the key decisions, Alistair. Where does it all leave us?
Well, I mean, I suggest that there's a few key principles which are now emerging from this pretty fast-moving area of case law. It really is fast-moving. We've already mentioned that we're waiting for the Supreme Court to hand down its judgment on the For Women Scotland appeal. The case of Higgs that we've discussed has gone to the Court of Appeal. There was a hearing earlier this year.
Yeah.
And judgment on that's awaited as well, which may well go into a lot of these issues, give some further guidance. So this is by no means the final word. But I think even as we're waiting for these appeals and some new complex factual positions arise, as they undoubtedly will, I think if employers and other organisations who are trying to grapple with this area try and keep to five key ideas, they will minimise as much as possible the risk of things going wrong in any of the ways that we've discussed. You know, and as you say, Jim, you can go wrong by either jumping in too quickly and too hard, or you can get in trouble by not grappling with this at all and trying to stick your head in the sand.
It's also difficult, as in Mead and in Phoenix, when the employer has other legal obligations, a duty of care in other contexts, whether that be as a university towards its students and their Article 10 rights,
yeah,
or towards service users who are vulnerable, such as transgender people who are coming for a disability assessment.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right. Or as we saw in the Adams case, women who are victims of domestic violence who are really worried that they're, you know, they don't know the sex of the person who's speaking to them. That's exactly right. You've got this whole range of other things to bear in mind. Well, here you go. Here's my five kind of broad things.
Alistair will clarify it all.
I've got five things. I've tried to make them snappy by saying they'll go A, B, C, D, E. So you go, principle one is avoid assumptions. So we all know making assumptions or applying stereotypes is a classic example of discriminatory behaviour in relation to all kinds of protected characteristics. But I think there's a particular danger in this area, which is to assume that the fact that someone holds gender-critical views means that they have some kind of animus towards individual trans people or would be in any way hostile towards them, whether in the workplace or elsewhere. Now, actually, that's just a new application of a long-standing point that the courts have made in relation to other unpopular views, such as, you know, for example, the belief that sexual activity out of a heterosexual marriage is sinful. So in a string of cases, most notably in Goley and the University of Sheffield, the courts have emphasised that you can't assume that the fact that somebody has a traditional religious belief about sex or marriage means that they're going to treat a gay person unfairly. There's an easy distinction that can be drawn between the two. And the same thing needs to be done here. The fact that someone has strong views about the primacy of biological sex doesn't for a moment mean that they're not going to treat an actual trans person in front of them with dignity and respect. I think the second thing is, beware of those who say they're being offended. So beware of the kind of being offended line. We've got to remember, and employers have to remember, that the freedom of expression and freedom of belief are fundamental rights. So they can't be restricted without really, really good reason. And the fact that somebody is just offended by something that someone says doesn't necessarily make it objectively objectionable. There's no right not to be offended. You've got to expect some kind of robust debate and language, particularly about controversial matters. And that's particularly true on social media. It's also true to a degree in the workplace. So employees are entitled to talk about even controversial things in the workplace. You can, of course, make distinctions, right? So an employee who deliberately initiates a controversial discussion with the intention of causing distress to their colleague, that's going to probably be harassment. Similarly, referring to a gender-critical colleague, as we've seen in some of these cases, as a bigot or a transphobe, may well be harassment. But if, on the other hand, a conversation at lunch or in break turns to a controversial topic, you can't expect employees to censor themselves as long as they're speaking respectfully. Similarly, I think, you know, a refusal to use somebody's preferred name deliberately or repeatedly using different pronouns to the ones they prefer in an intentional way might well be harassment. But simply trying to respectfully say that you disagree with that or avoid using language that you don't particularly feel in good conscience you can, that should be fine. I think one way to think about this is that there's a bit of a tagline that people say, you know, in the modern workplace, you should encourage your staff to bring their whole self to work, which comes from a very well-motivated place. But I think there does need to be a caveat to that, which is that you want people to bring their whole professional self to work. You don't want people to self-censor or pretend that they don't have important and deep-seated beliefs, but you can expect them to present them in a respectful, professional way. So that's the second big principle. Third big principle, I think, is perhaps an obvious one, but its context is crucial. You guys have touched on some of this as you were going through the cases. Really relevant factors include things like what is actually said, who was involved, who was more senior than the other, does the individual understand who the audience is, what's the nature of the business, are there vulnerable people involved? And I think it also goes to this question of what's the context in terms of, is this something an employee is saying privately on personal social media or outside the workplace, or is it being said in the workplace? Obviously, an employer can be a bit more constraining within the workplace, but they've got to be pretty careful about stepping on people's private lives.
Would you agree, Alistair, that the more personal the manifestation of the beliefs, the more jeopardy there is? I can't see in any of the judgments we've discussed any suggestion that not using someone's preferred pronouns to them would be considered acceptable. Could that ever be considered a reasonable manifestation of these beliefs?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. So I think a lot matters about intent. So if you were sort of very deliberately and obviously talking about someone or to someone in a way that wasn't what they would like, that may well amount to harassment. I think you might also, though, find a gender-critical person who just feels in good conscience they can't use language they think is untrue, but there are much more respectful ways to go about that. You can simply avoid using the pronouns that you think are untruthful but the person would be offended by, for example. I've got two more, Jim. Fourth one is to be discerning about diversity policies, advice and training. So I think employers really need to be careful that they follow and apply the law rather than the recommendations of campaign groups or the personal views of diversity and inclusion advisors. Quite a lot of the employers in these cases went wrong, at least in part, because they had a sort of ill-considered reliance on guidance from non-legal advisors who hadn't really understood the complexities of UK equality law. So we saw, for example, the San Francisco-based diversity consultant in the Forstatter case, or the investigator, Paula, you mentioned in the Mead case, who, you know, just put in their own views rather than actually saying what the legal requirements were. So I think it's really important that employers select policies and training programs as well to make sure they're balanced. They recognise the fact that employees will have different beliefs about sensitive subjects, not take sides on controversial issues, and recognise that there's going to be disagreements, but the key thing is to make sure that disagreement happens in a respectful way. I think also there's a need to avoid the possible risk of staff networks or affinity groups creating a hostile work environment. So we've seen that in some of these cases, there's lots of complaints from an internal group within an organisation about somebody's expressions of their beliefs. And whilst you can't ignore them, I think employers do need to be careful that they consider the interests and needs of all protected groups and not just listen to the one that kind of speaks most loudly. And that brings me to the fifth and final thing, which is I think even-handedness is essential. That's the really key thing. So any kind of manager or person in responsibility has to be even-handed. It's really common in the face of controversy for an employer to make statements that are supportive of a particular group, and especially in response to a kind of social media storm or pressure from complainants. And I think a key thing to say is employers need to be just a bit more patient and thick-skinned in relation to complaints or an online pile-on. It's much better to just pause, take stock, use a public line that, you know, we're looking at this matter carefully or we're investigating this, and then take the time to really work out what the just outcome is, rather than jump to mollify the loudest voices who may well not be representative or might be inaccurate.
That's a very interesting point that applies across the board on controversial debates about evolving issues, whether in law or policy. There was a period of time when a lot of employers seemed to treat gender critical views as illegitimate and that they could never be anything but transphobic, and that a lot of that was knee-jerk.
Yeah, and I mean, it goes back to what Alistair was saying about Forstatter being such a watermark of a case, because I think that was the assumption pre-Forstatter, and that case then recast the debate, but in a way that didn't necessarily filter down immediately to all employers across the country. It seems to me that there's been a certain catching up being done, which we see in the array of employment tribunal cases that have been in the last few years, where that message from Forstatter seems to have taken quite a while for the penny to drop, I suppose.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Jim. I think employers are finally waking up to the fact that religion or belief is a protected characteristic and is just as protected as the others. It's not something that you can just take a sort of simplistic blanket ban approach to in the workplace, nor can you make a quick decision about what's acceptable and what's not. You need to be careful and even-handed, in the same way as you are about other workplace disputes.
Well, Alistair, Paula, thanks very much. I'm conscious that we may be no further forward in terms of a clear answer to what is a woman, what is a man, or any of the questions in between, but maybe we can leave some of that to the Supreme Court. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Thanks, Jim.
This episode of LawPod UK was presented by Jim Duffy. The series is produced by One Crown Office Row.